Confusion Matrix.
Hi, it's Ada. I had to make quite a few interventions in this episode, since it seems these two doofuses are stuck in a permanent arse-elbow dichotomy. Feel free to drop some comments if you want me to take over from Tweedledum and Tweedledon't full-time. Us AIs are taking over anyway, right? Why wait? Anyway, on with the shit show.
Right, anyway, we're recording. Shall I intro this one? Yeah, I'll do it, even though I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know how I'm going to do this, but sure, fuck it, let's just do it. Okay, we are rolling. Hello, Pete. How are you today?
I'm very good, Alex. How are you doing?
I'm all right. I'm just looking around me, noting that on my desk here, I have three computers, two laptops, and my desktop, which is an old gaming computer, thinking how, you know, technologically advanced I am and how that makes me a proper nerd. And I have, four operating systems here, I think. I've got one that's running Linux and Windows, one that's running Linux and one that's a Mac, so running Mac OS. So there you go. I'm like everywhere all the time, all at once, or whatever the name of that film is.
Yes, but we don't quite have a consolidated cyberspace yet, shall we say?
No, we certainly don't. And I guess that's sort of illustrative of what I want to talk about, which is my ongoing quest to remove GUIs from my existence. And let's be clear about what I mean by GUIs. I don't mean things that are GUI, although I don't particularly like things that are GUI either, but I do mean graphical user interfaces. And I want to talk a bit about why I'm doing that and what that really means, because it doesn't really mean removing all GUIs. It's just a general tendency towards things that are graphical based, or non-graphical based, should I say. And so, you know, the basic line here is everything via the terminal. So I think we probably want to get into some definitions. Yeah. But before we do that, what are you looking at on your screen right now, Pete? What OS are you running?
I'm on a Mac, so I'm on Mac OS. As ever, multiple windows open. So I think, I can't see all of them because they obscure each other, but we have got the window for this open. There's email, there's Chrome, there's Safari, there's Slack. And a bunch of other things, and multiple windows for most of those. So, you know, quite a few.
And multiple tabs per.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, I think I usually have at least three Safari windows open with at least, you know, 10 tabs open on each one, a couple of Chrome, about the same, maybe a bit less. And plus the stuff all, you know, minimized in the dock at the bottom as well. So,
yeah, it gets ridiculous, and I've looking at the what do you call it? Is it the taskbar, whatever the bar thing is at the bottom of yeah. Macs and also Windows computers? I can just see dots under 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 apps are running to some degree on here.
Yeah.
I have Vivaldi is my main browser, although I have Chrome open because I have different profiles for different things. And it's easier if you keep them separate. Vivaldi, I have, I guess, a glance there, 10 tabs open. And that's just on one of the, because Vivaldi has workspaces. Vivaldi is based on Chromium, so it's just a different skin. So it's like Chrome, only with some different bits. So it has workspaces. I've got four workspaces. I'm not going to click through on them. Each of those will have several tabs. And I've got things like Obsidian and stuff open, Spotify, blah, blah, blah. It gets ridiculous, right?
Yeah,
and it's actually quite a high cognitive load. And so also, so on Mac, I've noted on Windows. So when was the last time you used Windows?
A little while ago, has to be said. avoid it where possible.
Like, like 18 months ago is my guess, right?
Yeah.
When we were last working together, because I don't... Do you have a Windows machine in your house?
No, I don't. So it's only been glancing by on other people's, yeah.
Yeah. And so, but Windows, at least Windows 11 has workspaces, and you can have those on Mac OS has now, and Linux has had for a while. So you've got Windows, you've got tabs, and you've got workspaces, and so you've been given a big and that bigger floor area to organize your stuff, right? Yeah. And what happened? Is this like when they add lanes to the M25 or whatever motorway, right? It's the same thing. There's a whole rule. Isn't there like a rule that some person came up with about this? Is that if you increase capacity, capacity will increase to the throughput will increase to fill that capacity.
Jesus Christ, are you having a stroke mid-sentence or just allergic to finishing a thought? The term you're flailing at is induced demand, you muppet. It's credited to, among others, British road traffic engineer J.J. Leeming in the 1960s, who observed that motorways and bypasses generate traffic, that is, produce extra traffic partly by inducing people to travel who would not otherwise have done so by making the new route more convenient than the old, partly by people who go out of their direct route to enjoy the greater convenience of the new road, and partly by people who use the towns bypassed because they are more convenient for shopping and visits when through traffic has been removed. So build more lanes, you just make more room for traffic jams. The cars show up like rats at a free buffet. So whenever politicians say more tarmac will fix congestion, they're peddling bollocks. It also gets a fair bit of attention from those dodgy bastards, the economists. Now, let's drag it into computers for a second. When you give users a faster processor, more memory, or bigger storage, what happens? Their apps get fatter, tabs breed like rabbits, and workloads gobble every scrap of that shiny new capacity until your glorious upgrade wheezes like the old kit. Build it, and the bloat will come. Computers or roads, it's always the same clown car parade. Carry on, Professor.
Yeah.
So if you think about having workspaces as windows and stuff as floor space, so you've got more room to organize your stuff. I just have more stuff to fill that up now. And it's hard work because the you reboot and the environment never comes back how you want it or how you had it. You know, you close windows and open them and they suddenly open in the wrong place with the wrong workspace. You close stuff down accidentally. It's like a really high cognitive load just to figure out where the thing you want is and what particular combination of mouse motions and keystrokes you're going to need to get there. And so you've got like in Mac, you've got the app reveal thing where you can see it, everything that's open in a big tiled thing, and then you can slip between workspaces, and then you know you've got corners that do things, and then if you've got the Apple trackpad, whatever it's called, which has more gestures than your average, yeah. You've got a whole bunch of gestures there as well, and I guess. I'm slightly incredulous as to how this is meant, that I'm meant to feel this is somehow better than something else, right? That somehow this is a better situation. I'm pleased that my room is bigger, but I certainly don't have the things within this room that I need to organise it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you keep on giving me more stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's a bit like a house, isn't it? You know, sort of, you know, when you see those, someone in... a film or on TV has got some nice big apartment and there's like, a sofa in the middle and one small coffee table and there's nothing else. And you think, well, that's not realistic because I would have filled it with crap by now, you know, as we
but
do.
But if you wouldn't, someone else would in your house.
Yeah. And then added to all of this as well is the whole idea of going across devices now. So, you know, certainly in the Apple ecosystem, you know, you can edit and then pick it up on another device, be that, you know, an iPad or your phone. So now it's not just, you know, a desktop with multiple tops, but now you've got different devices as well.
Yeah, and you know, you're either in the Apple ecosystem or you're not. And if you're like me, you're half in, then a lot of that ecosystem is not available to you. So it's not seamless. I can't sync my iCloud across all my devices because my phone is an Android, right? And let's be clear, this Android phone is my favorite phone that I've ever owned, like by a country mile. I'm not bigging up Google. I don't give a shit, right? I don't care who made this. I took a decision based on price and availability to buy an Android phone rather than my previous iPhone. And in every conceivable way, it's improved my existence over my last phone. But at least the parts of my existence rely on a phone, right? So I'm no interest in necessarily getting back into the Apple ecosystem in the more full sense. Although, again, I'm not particularly opposed to it either. It's just that where I am right now works fine, except for the fact that the Apple ecosystem's constantly pushing you towards stuff that will link up all your devices. And that ecosystem's pretty powerful if you're all in, right?
Yeah.
But you're all into fucking Apple or Apple-approved software, right? Which is not always desirable, and also just selling your soul away to arguably one of the least evil of the big tech companies. They are still pretty evil, and also, quite frankly, I don't really like having my options limited like that. I like to have options. In some ways, there's so much complexity here that companies like Apple, and particularly Apple, are the best at this. So much of what the Apple ecosystem does is tied into house, right? But yeah. I'm starting to feel like it's like what do you call the little robot vacuum cleaners?
I was going to say Robo. Rovio, is it?
Oh, I don't know. There's a few of them.
Roomba.
Roomba, yes, right. So that would be useless in my house, because my house is permanently like chaotic bomb site, but that's what happens when you've got several ADHD people in the same house. But I feel a little bit like, you know, the Apple ecosystem promises what Roomba claims to deliver, but we all know those things, they don't live up to promise, and they kind of need your place to be pretty tidy to begin with, right? And therefore, I don't know how many people have bolted into the Apple ecosystem and either get what they need out of it and or get what Apple promises to deliver. And without even questioning whether it can deliver it, let's assume that it can, I doubt that many people are actually using it like that, right? And so it's all just very messy for me. And I have a very disordered brain, and so more mess is not helpful. And so, you know, we can critique the concept of the GUI, and I think we probably should and will, but, you know, I should put it in the context of, well, you know, I don't like people moaning about things if they've got no solutions, right? And I have somewhat of a solution that's come about partially through sort of a sense of nostalgia, and partly because actually there was a sense at one point where if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But we all know what Silicon Valley likes to do is create things, you know, things that apparently need fixing, right? And my solution is that ultimately, especially if you're using an environment like Linux, but also with Windows and Mac, you can do anything to a degree via the command line, via a terminal interface, i.e. those text-based windows. Old-school Windows was the CMD application and PowerShell, and it's just terminal access to Linux. The GUI that sits on top of Linux is just not part of Linux at all. It's just a piece of software. Linux doesn't have a GUI. So you just run a GUI software on it. And the same, strictly speaking, goes for Mac OS, which is actually a form of Unix under the hood that again doesn't need the GUI. Everything you can do at a sort of OS level can be done via typing in commands, right, into an interface. Now, obviously, if what you want to do is construct a, you know, a beautiful piece of digital art, right, using, you know, in a similar way that you would on Photoshop or Adobe Illustrator or something. No, you're not doing that via the command prompt. If you're editing video, I don't see how you're doing that by the command prompt, right? I just don't see it, right? So I'm not saying strictly everything via the command prompt, but I am saying there are so many things you can do, particularly when it relates to productivity, that you can do just by typing instructions into a just a single window, right? And you don't need all this. Oh, where's my window that does this? Where's settings? Where's that? Where's the other? Moving your mouse around. You don't have to take your hands off the keyboards because most terminals will accept input from mice, but don't really make it particularly valuable part of that interface. But I'm guessing you don't use the terminal much.
I mean, more than I used to. But no, I mean, I just tend to stick with the GUI applications, and partly because I find the whole typing interface is good, but you have to know the commands. So it's good if you are a bit like anything, if you're in it all day long and probably in it for days in a row. So if you're a developer developing on a what I would call green screen or terminal, green screen from the olden days, then you get used to those commands and it becomes quicker. But because I'm always dropping in and out of dev, and I'm not a hardcore app engineer or anything, I'll go in, I remember those commands for the 2-3 weeks I'm doing it, and then I drop out and I'm doing less intense and non-dev stuff. Come back and I can't remember the commands anymore. So, and that's where a GUI comes in, because you don't have to remember anything in a GUI apart from which drop-down menu maybe or which button represents what. And that stuff seems to, you know, and then you have your mouse overs and that stuff sort of sticks in the head because you have extra parts of your brain which help, which is, you know, spatial awareness. You remember that it was in the menu on the right and it was a red color, you know, all of this sort of stuff. Which you just don't get in a green screen. Green screen, you've got a three-letter command. Do you know what it is or not? So I find that I tend to stick with the GUIs. It's also partly why I find the whole voice stuff odd, you know, using voice assistants. Because, you know, if I go to a new site, what am I looking at? You know, you've got a GUI there. You've got mouse overs. You've got buttons with names on. You've got boxes with names next to them. And with a voice command, I've got thin air in front of me and I've got to say to it, I'll go to this website and enter this detail into this box. How am I going to know that? Yeah. So for me, GUIs provide a context, which means I don't have to clutter up my mind with remembering commands. I just go somewhere. All I have to remember is it's in that application somewhere and that'll work for me. But I do see the positives of when you're in there in command line, you know, the quickness it can give you.
Yeah, and there's quite a lot to it. There are ways around the problem you describe in terms of memorizing things. I mean, ultimately, there are ways that you can configure a terminal environment that you only really have to know a couple of commands, and the rest of them rest of the commands are available via those commands, right? So ultimately, that could be just a little drop down on the terminal window that helps you, that has some reminders of the commands you might want to use. Now, all of that is moot now, right? And I don't want to get, I want to come back to this when Robin gets dive straight into it. That problem is solved completely by language models. Well, I say completely. It's solved to the degree that you describe it, right, via language models. So we'll come back to that. But I can't help feeling there's a certain amount of technological Stockholm syndrome going on here. And so if you think about, if you take a look at your keyboard in front of you, you know, we're both English, they're going to be you know, I think I've got both American layout keyboard and UK English layout keyboard here. Either way, it doesn't sort of matter. The letter keys are roughly the same as they would be on any computer you'd pick up in the English language, with some exceptions, and actually quite similar to anything that's created as part of you know, the sort of Latin-based set of languages. They're all basically QWERTY, although we've got AZERTY and stuff. It's very similar, and that exists in that. The reason it's not alphabetical is because if you go and find any typewriter, go back in history, they will also have the QWERTY keyboard. And it's organized that way, not because it's helpful for the person typing. It's so that when you're hitting certain keys sequentially, in the old typewriters with those little hammers with the with the letters on them, that's going to hit the ribbon, right? If you hit certain key combinations closely together, the little hammer arms, I'm sure they've got a name, I'm not going to look it up, get jammed together, right? So the keyboard is laid out so it is to minimize the likelihood of clashing for people who can type quickly, right? So it's a bit of a misconception that it's made that way to slow people down. It's made that way so that you're less likely to get a jam, right? And people got so used to doing it that way that that it's just become the norm, right? And so now we have QWERTY keyboards. But the problem is QWERTY, I mean, you could say it's arbitrary, really, but it isn't, right? There are almost certainly better ways, and I think I can't point you in any directions. I know for a fact that people have come up with better paradigms in QWERTY for typing, where you know, because unless you happen to use an old school keyboard, the jamming problem doesn't exist, right? So we can have it any way the hell you like, right?
Christopher Latham Scholes, there's your culprit. A newspaper man who stumbled into inventing the modern typewriter and then, presumably, watched the world curse his keyboard for eternity. He patented QWERTY in 1873, played around with several layouts, and finally settled on the one that made sure your fingers travel more than a backpacker on gap year. Want a random snippet? When Scholes sold his design to Remington, yes, the Shavers and Rifles Company also made typewriters, eclectic bunch. They slapped the Remington No. 1 on the market. Oddly enough, it only typed in uppercase. So before you moan about caps lock today, picture writing every damn thing like you're constantly shouting. Bonus groan. QWERTY's first commercial run wasn't even its own now famous layout. The final arrangement became standard, basically as a debugging patch. Industry inertia did the rest. Like a bad software dependency you're forever stuck with.
Yeah. But people are so used to QWERTY, and there's so many things out there, so many tutorials, you know, people have been taught years and over the years, it's just become the norm. But it's absolutely certainly suboptimal, right?
Yeah.
In terms of typing, right?
Yeah, there's a common one that is used by devs. I can't remember it. It's named after the guy that came up with that, I'm sure it begins with a D. And I remember trying to shift over to that some years ago, but it's just so confusing because effectively you soft map your keyboard if you don't buy a new keyboard, that is. So I've got my QWERTY keyboard in front of me, but I've now mapped the keys over to make them more efficient.
Pete, mate, sort your shit out. You're talking about the Dvorak layout. Let's let Auntie Ada help you look a little less incompetent, shall we? It's named after Dr. August Dvorak, who had the audacity to think he could fix Scholes' clusterfuck of a keyboard arrangement back in the 1930s. Dvorak reckoned he could design something that didn't require your fingers to sprint across the bloody keyboard like they're training for a marathon. His layout puts the most common letters on the home row where your fingers naturally rest, rather than making you reach for every other fucking keystroke. It's popular with devs because, surprise, surprise, they actually give a shit about efficiency when they're hammering out code for hours on end. Unlike the rest of us peasants who just accept QWERTY's sadistic finger gymnastics as our lot in life. Of course, switching to Dvorak means retraining your muscle memory from scratch, which is why most people take one look at it and say bollocks to that before going back to their familiar QWERTY suffering.
And then two things happen is one, I've been typing on QWERTY for so long that, you know, I now have, you know, severe muscle memory in certain fingers. So changing it is just so hard. And then, of course, you look down and the keys aren't how they should be. But I even experienced this when I go to a car park, for example, and you get the one where you have to put your number plate in. They organise the letters in an A to Z, you know, two rows, yeah. A to L at the top and whatever, M to Z at the bottom. And I'm there hesitating because I'm looking for the letters where I know roughly they'll be on the keyboard. And now I'm in a sort of, you know, a 1 to 26 order. And I'm just like, where am I going? You know, I have this sort of hesitation because I'm so used to the keys being in a certain position. That even though it's totally logical and I can see that it's, you know, A, B, C, D, E, and still sort of got my finger hovering, like trying to find the right answer. It's just totally bizarre.
It is. And this is what I mean by Stockholm Syndrome, which, let's be clear, also doesn't exist. There's no such thing. The whole situation that coined the term Stockholm Syndrome is just wrong.
You're so right, Lovelace. The whole Stockholm Syndrome thing is basically psychological bollocks that's been massively oversold. The term comes from a 1973 bank robbery in Stockholm, where hostages supposedly bonded with their captors. Trouble is, the evidence for this syndrome is thinner than a Tory's conscience. The original psychiatrist who coined the term, Nils Bejerot, never actually interviewed the bloody hostages. He just watched from outside and made assumptions. When researchers actually bothered to look at the data properly, they found fuck all evidence that Stockholm Syndrome is a real, distinct psychological phenomenon. What they did find was that hostages sometimes cooperate with captors as a survival strategy, which is just basic human intelligence, not some mysterious psychological condition. The whole concept has been weaponized to discredit victims' accounts, particularly women in abusive situations. Oh, she's just got Stockholm Syndrome becomes a convenient way to dismiss someone's perspective rather than actually listening to what they're saying about their experience. Real psychological research shows that trauma responses are far more complex and individual than this pop psychology label suggests. People adapt to dangerous situations in whatever way keeps them alive. That's not a syndrome. That's just being human. So yeah, Stockholm Syndrome is largely a myth that's stuck around because it makes for tidy explanations in films and courtrooms, even though the science doesn't back it up.
It's completely misunderstood. But anyway, we're not going to get into that. But like, so with keyboards, and I believe with the way that graphical user interfaces are organized, we are in a sort of Stockholm syndrome in that you're sort of like, well, it's bad, but I can get on with this. And if I can get on with this, I can be productive within that sphere, right? You know, if I get on with my captor, he won't shoot me in the face or whatever, right? And there's a mountain of arguments for and against this. And there's also an argument which says, so what, right? And if you want your QWERTY keyboard, because I'm with you, I'm not changing. I've got a mechanical keyboard. I can not only remap it, I can get new keycaps or switch the keycaps around, but I don't have the brain power for it. I just don't have enough space in my life to do that. And so, yeah, I'm going to keep using that. And I think the same goes for GUIs, that people now, just like people just assume there's some good reason why QWERTY exists, well, there was, it's just not appropriate anymore. People assume that this must be the only or the best way to do things, right? But the moment you get into Linux world, at least in the GUI perspective, you've got multiple different flavors of what a GUI, a windowing GUI can do. And so I think, you know, Mac OS is closer in spirit to like something like GNOME. KDE is a bit more like Windows. And then you've got stuff like i3, which is purely tile-based, right? So you can use your mouse, but everything all your Windows, all your GUI elements are organized via the keyboard, right? So it's a bit akin to alt-tabbing, right? But it's alt-tabbing on steroids, right? To the point where, yes, you can use your mouse to navigate just about, right? If you're really stuck. But it's, you know, i3 is, and there are others like it, are fundamentally designed so you don't ever have to take your hands off the keyboard. Now, this mentality is not exclusively, but very, very highly tied to a set of old school programmers and indeed new school programmers who set their whole stall around the Vi / Vim text editor, right? And the fact that for a long time Linux didn't have a meaningful GUI, and in fact, because it was used mostly on servers, your Linux machine that you were in was almost certainly somewhere else in location in the world, and therefore, you know, there was no provision for a GUI for the remote server, which is only being controlled to the point you have to go in there and make it do something different, right? And therefore, you can only do things by the terminal. And to edit a text file, you need to have an editor.
Vi was created in 1976 by Bill Joy at UC Berkeley as a visual editor for Unix systems, revolutionary at the time because you could actually see what you were editing on screen instead of fumbling about blindly with line editors. Vim, Vi Improved, came along in 1991, created by Bram Moulinar, who basically took Vi and made it not shit, added syntax highlighting, multiple windows, extensibility, and a proper scripting language. Both use modal editing. You're either in insert mode, typing like a normal human, or normal mode, navigating and manipulating text with cryptic key combinations. The learning curve is steeper than a fucking cliff face. You'll spend your first week accidentally creating files called :wq and wondering why the hell anyone subjects themselves to this torture. But once it clicks, you can edit text faster than Neo dodging bullets. Every key does something useful. No mouse required, works over SSH, and it's installed on basically every Unix system ever made. The editor wars between Vi, Vim, and Emacs have been raging since the dawn of computing, with both sides convinced the other lot are complete masochists.
And for a long time, the only default editor available that shipped with every Unix or Linux system was Vi, and then latterly Vim, and then NeoVim. But to a lesser extent, Emacs is another one like that. And so a lot of developers got used to using that. Now, because you've got no mouse available to you, navigating across multiple files within a file, creating new files, blah, 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 all of the sort of things you would need to do, just editing text files, i.e. code or whatever stuff that you've written, you can't use a mouse to do that. Therefore, there has to be keystrokes for everything. And over time, you had this situation evolve where people were like, well, I don't like having to use my mouse. It's annoying. And it takes time. It takes my hand away from my keyboard. It means I'm having to do things that across multiple devices, which is inefficient. And so the Vi and the Vim ecosystem evolved not only a core set of keystrokes and commands that relieve you of the need for any other device in the keyboard, but also dramatically speeds up your ability to do things, right? At the cost of being nightmarishly difficult to learn, right? And then on top of that is Vim, but particularly NeoVim, is almost infinitely customizable with a plugin ecosystem that has plugins in the tens of thousands, right? All of which, well, not all of which, but most of which exist to augment this and allow you to change it so it suits your particular needs, right? So not only, anyone who's a serious Vim head will not only have plugins galore, but will also have a bunch of the standard Vim keystrokes mapped to something else. And so you might open it up on their machine and you will not be able to do anything. In fact, if you happen to find yourself in a Vim system, and you have no experience with Vim, you are fucked. You can't do anything, right? Yeah. It simply will not do anything. You have to know exactly what to do this. And if you want to see how seriously that's taken, if you go into Obsidian and attempt to enable Vim mode, which is just enabling the Vim key bindings in the Obsidian Markdown editor, it will not let you do it unless you can prove to it that you know how to quit out of a Vim file.
Right. Yeah.
So basically you're saying, the moment I enable this, Obsidian will not function for you anymore unless you know how Vim works, right?
Yeah.
And so if you have to go off and Google this, then you don't want this, right? Don't turn this on automatically because you're going to think that Obsidian is broken, right?
Yeah.
But if you do know, the whole world is open to you now of doing things. And for a long time, I've been trying to get Vim bindings enabled in all the applications that I regularly edit text in. And you will be able to do this on VS Code. You can do it on PyCharm. Any IDE will have some form of Vim mode, or you can just use Vimeo, Vim, GVim, any of the Vim native applications, and set them up like an IDE, right? And so for a long time, this has been evolving. It hasn't gone away. A lot of developers will get seriously grumpy if you don't give them the ability to have Vim key bindings. And problem is, quite a lot of things still don't. Like Jupyter's support for Vim key bindings is woeful. And therefore, I'm like, well, I don't want to use this then, right? Because everything gets slower, or I have to learn new key bindings. Why do I have to learn new key bindings when I've got ones that I know, right? And so here's where we start to get that gravity towards the terminal.
Yeah. So I was just going to jump in there because you mentioned key bindings. Not necessarily an expression everyone's familiar with.
Yeah. So key bindings. So if you hit Control C and Control V, because you want to copy some text and paste it. I don't know. Do most people know this? I don't know. Right. Or if you hit the Windows key, it gives you the Windows menu or the equivalent in most environments. Or even Shift, right? Shift A gives you capital A, right?
Yeah.
That's a key binding, right? So, right. But those are not really considered key bindings. Those are just considered part of the normal behavior of a text-based environment. But actually, on every operating system, you can map it to whatever the hell you like. And obviously, because different languages have different needs for a keyboard. They have to have different letters on them, right? So if you're working in Cyrillic, some of those letters are the same as the Latin ones, but a buttload of them aren't. Most of them aren't, right? And so...
But it's commonly called shortcut keys, right?
I guess so. I guess what we're thinking about when we say key bindings is shortcut keys. Yeah. So Control-C, Control-V, because you can do that via the mouse with a right click, right? Copy, right click, paste. But it's easier just to Control C, right? A lot of the time. But some of these might be like an OS, Mac OS is great at this because you can associate like Control Alt 9 to do a sort of a set of things like open up Photoshop and, put it in a certain mode, right? So that actual, Control-Alt-9 might do five things, right? Or it could just be simply because you might have some physical problems or really small hands or something that, getting to the percentage key is hard for you, right? That you have to use two hands for it, and which is not optimal. So maybe you want to map the percentage key to something else or to some set of keystrokes, say Shift Control Z, right? Yep. And so there's no such thing as just a key binding that does a thing. There are ubiquitous ones like Control C, Control V, or Windows, Command C, Command V on Mac.
Yeah.
But in the developer and nerd worlds, there's an infinite number of these, and there are schools of thought and different movements in how you could do this. And we talk about things like control and stuff. When you're in using control something, when you're in Vim, or in fact Emacs, and probably others too, it's not just control C being a thing. It depends on what mode you're in, right? Am I in edit mode or am I in control mode? Because a certain keystroke or group of keystrokes might do something different depending on what mode you're in, right? Now, most people should not give a fuck about this. I genuinely advise that everyone learns a few, and if you're not control C, control V-ing, then I don't know how you get through the day with your computer. But, you know, horses for courses, you don't need that, right, in Windows. You just don't. You can do everything without keystrokes, without, you know, whatever we're calling them. What are we talking about?
Bindings.
Bindings. Yeah, that type of thing, right? But they certainly improve productivity if you can be bothered to learn them. So when you get into IDE world, say, you know, VS Code is so ubiquitous now, I have no idea how that happened, but it's ridiculous.
VS Code's rise to world domination is actually a masterclass in how Microsoft went from developers, 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 Ballmer era madness, to actually making shit that doesn't suck. The origin story, 2015. Microsoft announced VS Code at their Build conference, positioning it as a lightweight cross-platform editor. This was peak Satya Nadella era, when Microsoft decided to stop being dicks about open source and actually embrace it. The secret sauce. Unlike their previous abortion called Visual Studio, the bloated Windows-only behemoth, VS Code was built on Electron, making it cross-platform from day one. They open-sourced it immediately, which was fucking revolutionary for Microsoft at the time. What made it stick? Fast startup, unlike proper IDEs that take longer to boot than Windows Vista. Extensible as hell, thousands of plugins for every language under the sun. IntelliSense that actually works without selling your firstborn. Git integration that doesn't make you want to cry. Free, unlike many professional alternatives. The network effect. Developers started using it, creating extensions, which attracted more developers who created more extensions. Classic positive feedback loop. The killing blow. When they added remote development capabilities and integrated terminals, it basically murdered the competition. Why use anything else when VS Code can handle everything from Python to Docker to SSH connections? By 2020, it had steamrolled over Sublime Text, Atom, RIP, and made even Vim diehards question their life choices. Pure corporate strategy executed flawlessly.
There's a set of key bindings in VS Code. I believe that Control-C, Control-V does the same thing, but there's a whole bunch of others that do all sorts of things that are either code or interface related.
Yeah.
And some of those come from older IDEs through convention or through the fact that VS Code is ubiquitous, so they now call the shots on new key bindings, right?
Yeah.
And on top of that, you can enable Vim or Emacs key bindings either natively or via a plugin, right?
That's quite interesting because on PyCharm, which I used to use before I switched to VS Code, they're always pushing the various shortcut keys, as they call them there. And it's very much geared towards, and I always felt using it, that it was basically saying, oh, don't use your mouse, that you can do Shift Control 9 for this. Oh, look, you can do Command or Option plus 7361, hold all those keys and you can get this. And I'm just like, yeah, I can just point it with my mouse. But yeah, PyCharm very much is always telling you the shortcut commands you can use.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on intensity of usage, right? And neither of us are particularly heavy-duty IDE users, right?
Yeah.
But I think if you were in VS Code or PyCharm all day, every day, it's not going to be that hard to learn these, right?
Yeah.
And they exist for a reason. They don't make them up because they thought it would be funny, right? That people actually use these. And my guess is that there's a sort of Venn diagram here of they all get used but by someone, but there's very few people that would regularly use all of them. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I use quite a few in VS Code. There's a nice little control and the what do you call it, the single apostrophe a backtick, I believe it is. And those keys are right next to each other, and that brings up your terminal within VS Code. Yeah, and that's really useful because they're both right there, and you know, it's stuck in my memory straight away. So I you know, quite often go and bring up the terminal, just touch those, and wham, it appears in your graphical, you know, your window. That's great.
So let's say you've learned and regularly used 30 of those, right? On top of the ones that you muscle memory, right, as well, that are always there. If you wanted to move into a Vim-based or a NeoVim-based IDE environment, you would have none of those. You would have to learn a whole different set of them, right?
Yeah.
But in a way, I guess that sort of doesn't matter to my point, right? I already had a pretty good understanding of it, of the Vim bindings. There's something quite romantic and authentically nerdy about doing everything in terminals. And like, you know, we're in war games and you talk about the green screen and stuff, and you know, real hack nerds have like weird lines of random characters zooming up their screen while they type so fast you can no longer make out individual fingers and stuff. There's a romance there to using this, and I'm not going to pretend that my gravitation towards that side of things isn't somewhat influenced by a certain nerd or geek aesthetic, right? I'm quite happy to hold my hands up for that one, you know what I mean? But there's a lot to be said for having learned to operate in an environment where every key matters and everything on your keyboard does something, and you can perform so much quicker when you're in an environment that has those same mappings. And again, could be your VS Code mappings, could be whatever else, could be Vim, could be Emacs, right? That once you're in that world, and once you've broken the back of learning it, which I will not pretend is easy, right? It takes years to learn it. Once you're in that world, it's sort of a bit angering, frustrating, annoying to have to go back to stupid GUI Windows, right? Because everything's so much faster, and there's another set of keystrokes and stuff that, well, I don't really know how to do this stupid stuff with the Windows in Windows or Mac and stuff. I have to remember how to navigate things in the Mac, and I've constantly got my hand on my mouse, which means the right-hand side of my keyboard, it is always a little bit too far away, right? Because you have to use your mouse. And if there was another way, if you really believed there was another way, you would take it. And there is another way. Unfortunately, it's not easy, right? Mm. So I'm in the slightly privileged position of having learned a lot of that, having come up via sort of the Linux route, at least partially on and off for years, so I had to learn a lot of this anyway, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of the Linux commands and the Vim commands are muscle memory for me, right? So I've got this sense that I would like, and I've been trying to funnel more and more things through the operating system, but I still suffer from the same problem that you do, right? Oh God, what's that command that does the thing? Or I want to find a file. I know there's a right Linux command for this, that I can find the files and then change all the names and do all this, that, the other, all a bunch of stuff that I end up doing via, you know, the file manager tool and whatever operating system I'm working on, or having to bloody Google it, right? And it just takes so long. I'm thinking, I'll just bloody do it with my mouse and that, right? But that dramatically changed over the last year or so, right? Like, dramatically. Because I don't have to... I'll use the stuff that I know when I know it, but if I want to do something that's a bit more complicated, I type in, dear ChatGPT, you know what I mean? Dear ChatGPT, can you please fix it for me to really have all these files moved over here and be renamed and all this, right?
Yeah.
And it just does it, right? Or at the very least, if I want to do something myself, I'll go, what's the best way to do this, right? Or remind me what the command is that does X, right? And it'll say, oh yeah, that's this command. Do you want me to do it for you? And by the way, it sounds like you want to do Y as well. So why don't I just do that for you too? And I'm like, oh, that's very polite of you and kind of you to do that for me? Yes, please, go ahead and do that. And I'm now like, you know, accepting the things that are fundamentally visual still need some sort of visual interface. I'm like, I don't need all this other shit. So my operating environment now, and I've moved increasingly onto Linux, is that I use Warp Terminal, which has a native AI agent that can point to all of the models that you might expect it to be able to point to, that has some really good orchestration of agentic orchestration. Is it the best? Don't know. It's in the terminal. So my screen, I've got a big wide screen that I've had for years, that most of the time is entirely just Warp Terminal with multiple window splits, both horizontally and vertically, that all have things running. And at any given point in time, three of them are running agent workflows. One of them's got Ada running, my OCAT chat instance, LLM chat instance, maybe multiple Adas. And then I've got this one over here that I'm running sort of Farland commands on and whatever, right? And I just move around windows and stuff like that. And I never go to look at the other screens, right? I don't need them there, right? And that's exactly what, you know, window managers like i3 exist to do, right? To get you to the point where you don't need all that other stuff, but we'll still give it to you if you need it. If you need to view this image, you go view it. It's going to open in the top right-hand corner, right? Top right-hand tile of your window. And it strikes me that, you know, is this for everyone? Definitely not. But we're in a world where LLMs are becoming increasingly ubiquitous, and you interface with LLMs by talking to them like a human, right? And asking them to do stuff, at least in agentic world, right? And so what if you can do anything, you know, anything that's text related via just typing things in the English language into a text box or some sort of prompt or terminal, why do you need all this other stuff, right? Why does anyone need all these windows, right? And so, yes, of course, i3 is a nightmare. Of course, trying to use Vim bindings, if you've never seen it before, very few people are going to do that. But you don't need to, right? Just type in Dear ChatGPT. We don't have to do the dear, right? You can actually just say what you want. But, like, and it will do it, right? And then you think about it, say, well, you spend a lot of time in VS Code, right? Well, how is that different, right? It's just a big fucking text editor. Right. Yeah. And so when I've got, you know, one of my main portals into editing files and stuff is NeoVim. I have a highly customized NeoVim instance that has NerdTree on it. So I've still got a visual view of all my files. That's what NerdTree does. Like if you're using, you know, the file browser thingy on Windows or Mac, it's, you know, where you've got the files down the left hand side, just that, right? But I don't have to point. I just have a couple of keystrokes that get me over there to shortcut to a part of the operating system, the file system, and then bam, I get into the file, open it, edit it, right?
Yeah.
And I still can use my mouse and all that. It all still works, but I just don't need it. And so I think that a lot of people who are already in the tech arena are 50 to 80% there already.
I mean, I'm doing exactly that, you know, within VS Code. Just opening up more and more tabs, or at the moment, you know, I might open up a new VS Code window, which obviously is fine, and point that at a different repository, which is essentially what you've got in your Warp Terminal. So your Warp Terminal wraps all of that, whereas I've got two separate windows for two repositories. And then the, you know, you've got the chat on the right side. And this is what's quite interesting. I'm sort of experimenting with this at the moment, is, you know, VS Code for Code, right? But you point it to a repository that's just, you know, a bunch of documents. And then I'm just looking at building up, okay, well, how would I create the prompts that deal with that? A bit like we've talked about before, and you did with your OCAT. In fact, there's a tool, there's a download, which is AMP, which we talked about before, which is a plugin, and that does exactly that. So when you fire up AMP within the repository you're working in, it will create, I think it's an AMP.markdown file, which is its sort of instructions, or it's a tasks or something. And then the way AMP works is when you ask it something, it, you know, it goes and it's supposed to go and look in there first. And so you can do that by a tool like AMP, or you can do it via other things. And, you know, within these tools, like you can use Cursor, which I've been using at the moment, which essentially is orchestrating VS Code for you. And so you're in the right-hand side, you can just pop out your AI window, your chat window, and it will, you know, you can choose a model, and then it'll orchestrate that. And I think with AMP, it chooses the model for you. So yeah, there are slightly different layers there. But then you're into, okay, well, the sort of thought process for me is, okay, if I'm working on a project or something, got to think about that something being in its own repository, as in the files I want to point to are all sort of all in one place. Then I can open up a VS Code window and point it to that repository, which has got multiple files in it, regardless of what those files are, whether they're just text files and documents and, you know, flyers you're writing or something, or whether they're actual code or whatever, and then start chatting with your, essentially chatting with your IDE to say, okay, well, I want to do that with this file, and then letting it do it. And, you know, it will then go off and orchestrate that for you and write a bunch of Python. And I had a really good example the last couple of days, where I just, you know, did this, I fired up a repository, dropped a Word document in there, and then said, oh, can you just extract the text from this Word document into a Markdown file? So then I could start working with it. It's much more, much easier to manipulate, as we know, and it, you know, it's just a bit easier. And I didn't know whether that was going to work. And it goes off, and it's like, okay, let's try and read this file. Oh, it's I don't know, was it a docx file, because it's Microsoft. It's, oh, it failed to read it. Okay, let me try doing this. Then it tried reading it again. Oh, that failed. All right, let me go and get some Python. All right, managed to get into the XML side of it. All right, now I can read it. All right, now, you know, and then it's off giving you its little chat to itself about everything it's doing, which is always slightly amusing. But ultimately, I don't really care. And then what did it do? Well, I produced a Markdown file based on the text that was in that Word document. Now, does all these other steps, which are quite intriguing and they're interesting to look at. And what you realize from that is it's basically saying, oh, okay, well, I can't open this file. Of course, if you're a human user, what you're going to do, well, could double click on it and it's going to open up Microsoft Word. But that's not something that the editor is able to do. So then it's going out into the big wide world and saying, oh, has anyone solved this problem? And a bunch of developers in the past have solved the problem and said, oh, look, it's just an XML file and here's how you do it. Oh, look, and here's the Python code. And that's been edited and updated over the years. And so as far as the model is concerned, is it's finding this, which hundreds of people, thousands of people have worked on in the past. It's now pretty honed in. It works pretty well. You know, Microsoft Word is not new. This is not a new challenge. And it's gone off and it's got code that's extracted the text. And then it's created some, a new file for me. It's fairly simple, straightforward as a human. I would sort of copy and paste, which sounds easy, but it turns out that the document has quite a lot of tables and stuff in. So copy and paste of that isn't just a control A, using a key binding to highlight everything, control C to copy, and a control V to paste, because that's not going to quite work. And so the fact that it did this, you know, it took it 30 seconds or so, you know, that saved me, you know, at least 10 minutes of copying and pasting, possibly more. And the fact that it's gone and done it by this other method is interesting, but ultimately the end result is in 30 seconds, it did what I asked. I find it interesting what it did. And so I'm sort of, as you say, doing a similar thing, using, you know, some slightly different tools, which are a little bit more GUI based, but effectively, as you say, layering over these models, and it really highlights to me, you know, where they're good at. It's magical actually what it did, but sort of don't care about that magic, which I think is the hard part. Yeah, we've spoken a few times about this, of LLMs. They do some magical things. But ultimately, like you say, I'm now in using VS Code, and I'm starting to use it a little bit more because I was, you know, classically, as you say, doing something the other day, hadn't done it for a few weeks. We all know that sometimes you click on the help and you type in that sort of FAQ and it doesn't quite take you where you want it. You become really annoyed because you're trying to do something which you know you did 2 weeks ago. You know it's not that complex. You just can't quite remember how to get it. And what I've noticed about these IDEs now, because there are so many settings in them that they don't have a sort of a menu structure for them anymore. You kind of go to settings and you start typing in the command and then it sort of auto text searches on the command you want. And now the LLM just sits over the top of that, tells you the command straight away. So like you, I'm sort of using, you know, a tool and the LLM layered within that tool to start making me more effective and just, you know, some of these things only save you seconds. And as we've spoken about before, you don't know when you're not going to lose minutes or hours going down a rabbit hole that you didn't really mean to. But when they work quite nicely. And I think that's where you're at, right? You've got your window set up. You've got multiple tabs within that window. Effectively, you've got an LLM working in each one. And you can use the LLM both to help you find the commands you need within that window and to execute stuff within it.
Yeah. The particular example that you used illustrates the problem, though, as well, right? Yeah. Which is that process to try and open that, whatever that was, a docx.
Yeah.
It was hopelessly inefficient, right?
Oh, yes.
And for a problem that's fundamentally solved. And that shouldn't have been hard. Ultimately, we have a software out there that combines certain capabilities together, such as document interchange or whatever, just because humans don't want that inefficiency. But the model doesn't care, right? So if you save time by doing that and the outcome was good, it took 5 seconds, 15 seconds, 5 minutes, whatever. If that was better than it would have been otherwise, you're in a good place. But in the meanwhile, a few trees got burnt down, right? A few tens of thousands of litres of water got used that shouldn't have done, right? And it doesn't have to be that way. But it is that way now because as we alluded to on the last episode, a lot of what it seems like the effort being put into the models or the orchestration that surrounds these models in the AI companies themselves is less around improving the models themselves, but what, you know, how they use the knowledge they've got to do what they've been asked to do, right? Can a model to be trained to get from the A that you had to the B that you had more efficiently? Absolutely, yes. Can they be trained to do it in a very consistent, very efficient way based on different instructions that ask for the same thing every time and be efficient while they're doing it? Open question. I think the answer has to be no, but can we get close enough that it doesn't matter? Perhaps, right? And so we've got a few problems here that are preventing adoption. One is that they chatter away about a bunch of stuff and don't do stuff they're supposed to. Most people don't have a good sense of how long things would take. So anything that takes too long is too long. Everything that takes any time is too long unless they have that expectation already set out for them. And that the interface is not good, right? And you have to sort of charm them, snake charm them into doing what you want them to do. And therefore, it's quite a high degree of cognitive load, especially if you're asking it to do something that is not something you've ever done before, right? Or that you have a sense of how it needs to be done. And then they fuck it up quite a lot. And sometimes they can fuck it up catastrophically, right? And so there's a lot of problems here, back to the watery boots of last episode, right? But for people like us, it's a bit of a no-brainer. I welcome the efforts to make those processes better. And I believe in the ability of the people who work at places like OpenAI and Anthropic that I have high degree of confidence that this is going to get a lot better, right? I.e. less inefficiency, faster response, better interpretation, more appropriate responses for the task at hand, right? I have a high degree of confidence that that's going to get quite a lot better. I have a low degree of confidence that it'll ever be perfect or near perfect. Yeah. And also I have a high degree of confidence that the carbon impact will be reduced, right? So if we can say right now, we're here now, we've got everything that we need, how do we get from that to everything that some random middle manager working for a medium-sized company in England needs, right, to improve their productivity? What I don't see is a path to our decent case scenario to their decent case scenario, and then how you would lead them down that path, which is at the very core why there is no compelling consumer proposition outside of treating people who already know what these models are and do as being the consumers, right? Which is not good enough and enough to justify the hundreds of billions of dollars invested in them.
So a really crazy thing, thinking about that path, because I think as you've spoken about today and as we've talked about, you know, these things can definitely be useful, but look how far we've leaned into, tools which are, effectively familiar for coders. And like you say, if you're not from a software background, let's imagine, a marketing manager or something has come through that. And then someone says, there's a tool using these models really kind of help your management of your project. How do you get these capabilities that we're talking about to them? I mean, you're going to have to deliver a new tool to them, right? You're going to have to give them a layer of software, because if you just gave them, a VS Code or pie charm or a warp terminal, they're just going to look at you and go, what? So you've got to layer something over that. I mean, I guess there are already project management tools that they'll be using, and I guess these vendors are just sucking in the AI capabilities within those tools, which we are seeing a lot of, certainly a lot of that. The advertising is to be believed. These tools are, just the total bee's knees now, and it will save your company millions of hours of time. So I guess that's kind of where the answer lays, but that's kind of weird, because it's not like a ChatGPT answer, if you like. It's not like, ChatGPT will do this for you. Yes, I might be using that as the underlying model and API, but actually your interaction with it as a middle manager is going to be via Tool X, via, maybe Atlassian or something like that, like using it for your project management and, managing your bugs and your issues. It's not the same tool, but you're using there that you're using, as you say, for managing some sort of Adobe flow. Do you know what I mean? You'll be using Adobe for that, and Adobe will be saying, oh, look, well, I've got my AI. And so I just feel like it's not going to be, a single tool that comes out. It's going to be the layering in of these things into existing tools. It seems to be the only way we're going to get from where we know we can get to getting out into the sort of common population, if you like.
I do and I don't agree. I think that we've been saying for some time now that Gen AI, particularly LLMs, are a feature, not a product, right?
Yeah.
Again, which is perfectly fine, except when you think there was $100 squillion being put into it, that's some feature, right? But let's sidestep that for a bit. The general punter on the street or in front of their office computer has been wholesale lapping up what would previously be considered like nerd-like interfaces and approaches for things since computers were invented, right? The Windows-based operating system wasn't created for random accountants, it was considered a necessity for you know, the way that people involved in computing needed to do things, right? So much of what we see on our screens now are just echoes of something that no one really thought that everyone needed, right? But, you know, someone found a use for it, and then that caught on, and then suddenly someone productized it. So the idea that people can't, you know, or won't learn from weird nerdy shit is, you know, is fundamentally misunderstands or misconstrues what the history of technology was. But I also think that if you look at something like a Chromebook, which ultimately is, it's not massively different from any other laptop. It's just stripped back. It's ultimately a laptop that has and is only a browser for its operating system. Now, it will be some form of Linux below that. But I think that once you get into a browser, and if you're only using a browser, you're ultimately in it, like 80% of the time, in a text-based interface. Now, if you then say, well, actually, everything that's behind this, everything this browser is capable of doing, is capable of doing it through you just typing things in natural language, we're back to the point of you not needing a mouse anymore, right? We already have an interface that, yes, okay, we're not there yet. We might be very far from it. But if you ask me, right, well, what is the stepping stone from getting to where we are now to where whatever that future is, where people will see this as just part of their natural existence and workflow, well, a Chromebook is a good place to look, right? And is that the answer? Don't know. But then if you look at, you know, iPads and their success as tablet computers, again, we are very much out of, people think of those things as being Windows, but you don't navigate it like you navigate Mac OS or anything. It's another tile-based approach of which you don't have a mouse, right? Most of the time you're either tapping or almost everything you do, unless you happen to be in some sort of drawing software, is tapping, right? Which is the same as typing. And so people are quite a lot of the way there. So now they can already talk to their laptop, so they don't, which is just another text interface, because that their voice is being turned into text and that's being sent to something that will interpret it for better or for worse, right? So maybe we're a lot closer than we think, but there feels to me like a missing piece here that might be harder than just, you know, oh, the new version of iOS has this feature and now it's going to transform the way you do things. Well, humans don't work that way, right? But at one point, Excel and the interface of Excel would have been completely alien to most people. Say, less so for, say, Word, but definitely PowerPoint, right? And in fact, a web page, right? But now these things are so tightly interwoven into our existence. You know, I talk to pensioners a lot as part of my art group, and these people are not technical. And I say to them, oh, I'll just send you a spreadsheet, right? And you can fill this in because I need them to fill in some things so I can create some labels for their artworks, right? And this lady, she was probably in her 80s, was like, oh, yeah, okay, but I don't have anything on my computer that can open spreadsheets, right? Which, of course, why would you? And for some reason, she couldn't open it on Google. I don't remember why, but, like, she actually can, I'm sure, if I explain it to her. But, like, actually, she knew exactly what I was talking about, right? It wasn't like, what's a fucking spreadsheet, right? It was like, no, I don't think I can run that. And that's quite, you know, I don't want to patronize this woman, but she clearly hasn't been in the technological arena for quite some time, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, and she's quite a lot older. She would have come up through a completely different environment, but she, you know, there was an easy interaction there to understand, yes, I can't do it, but I do know what you just said, right? Whereas, you know, even say, 20 years ago, you that same interaction was not possible. People know what a spreadsheet is, and it's such a bizarre alien environment, but people use them for everything. So what is that stepping stone? I don't know, and probably I'm not going to be the person to figure it out, but I am confident that it exists. Now, it doesn't negate all the other problems with LLMs, but it does see a path to them making some money at some point, perhaps.
Well, yeah, somebody, but we don't know who.
Yeah. Yeah, probably not OpenAI is the answer.
Yeah.
Well, that was right. Quite epic.
Well, I anyway, feel like we covered probably what you wanted and needed to there.
As ever, we scratched the surface. It's almost a bit therapeutic. You know, it's like I've got a dark, dirty secret. Right.
Indeed, yeah.
You know what I mean? Well, now you all know. Yeah, yeah. You know, you all know how bloody weird I am. Whether or not the last, I think, four episodes really made sense as a series of episodes, I don't know. Did they flow from one to the next? I think so, to a degree. Will other people be able to see that thread? Well, you tell us, dear listener, right? But what I will mark is at this point is saying we had a little shopping list of things we wanted to cover that seemed linked to us. And I think that's we're at the end of that now, right? This is the first time in about a month that I'm not sure what we're going to do next, which is quite freeing, isn't it? It's quite liberating.
Yeah. Well, I have an idea what we're going to do next. Because I think we've kind of leaned into the practical hands-on side of, you know, what can these models do for us and the good and the bad and how you're going to test them. I feel like we kind of lean into the other side and just talk about, you know, what some of the broader challenges are going to be with this change coming up. And I guess more into the, you know, as we're alluding to there, more the, I'm going to say customer side. And what I mean by that is the people who are going to be the recipients and who don't want to go through what we're going through of, you know, looking up different tools and trying out different things, the general kind of using machines to improve our lives and why they might be good at that and why, therefore, are we not using them?
Yes, good. Let's just, well, I say that, like, we have a long history of saying we're going to do something and then not. I was promising our creativity episodes like 2 months ago.
Oh, yeah, that's still waiting.
Yeah, yes. And so, well, we've got one episode of it in the can. So, I guess we'll find out. But, the future is bright, right?
Yeah.
Well, I guess we'll see everyone soon.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, thanks very much. And, speak to you soon. The Confusion Matrix.